Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Kristen and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 166 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, everyone? What's up, Tristan? Episode 166. Who we bringing?
Aaron McKenzie,
Olympian. And you had to correct me before we went on air. Not just an Olympian, an Olympic gold medalist.
Twice.
Two times over. Have we had a two-time gold medalist on?
Steph Rice.
Race Rice. She won two of them? Now,
yeah. She won nine medals.
Jesus. Yeah. It's a medal good. Collection. So I'd like to see our total medal collection with all of our people we've talked to on the show.
Yeah, we've had some great, obviously a lot of fighters that have, you know, been in that sort of...
Yeah, the ones
Olympic
who got
games and
then the ones who got close but didn't, like Severn, he was at like four.
But if I heard a repeat and go back to back, it's quite a feat. It's very.
And they were two different Olympics. It wasn't like two gold medals in the same. It was what, 08 and 2012?
Yeah, it was Beijing and London.
Yeah, so Erin is an Olympic high level rower.
Yeah, she's in the women's eight, so it's the one where. Obviously, well, there's eight women in the boat.
No, there's actually nine.
But and then there's the lady that, yeah, the leader at the front that doesn't actually row, but she's the captain or something, is she? Or the coach?
There's a term for it. Like I don't want to.
I think she's going to bring it up on the episode for sure.
Yeah, another one of these. Tris and I, you know, you guys listening at home, we just keep opening up. Like I use an analogy like the playbook in terms of, you know, learning from different types of people, different types of characters. And with Erin, she's fresh out of a retirement. What, a few years ago she just hung them up?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah,
so it's going to be interesting just to pick her head in terms of, you know, the mindset and physicality of actually having to leave a sport. And how many great insights are we going to get from someone that's been to the top, one of the best performing athletes in the world?
So. Have you experienced anything like this?
In like, terms of...
Think about that, like whether it's in a career or that sort of... Because I, you know,
you mean
doing...
leaving?
Yeah, getting prepared for this interview, I kept trying to put... Like empathize with that mindset of that headspace, that emotional turmoil of having to let go of something that at one time you were really good at, but because of time, you're no longer required or you can't perform like that anymore.
Not really. Like even for myself, leaving stockbroking and then going to training for a few years and then going back, that always gave, I can always go back because there's no physical kind of implications, but she can never go back because she's not the same athlete that she was in 2012. Like, you know, time ages, you know what I mean? Like,
and that's just, real value for this upcoming chat because she's
being a human being, you know, it's just, it doesn't matter. It's not just Erin, it's Usain Bolt. Look what's happening to Usain at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, he's at the end of his career
and his body started breaking down
in 3 years' time. He would not probably place in the top three guys. It's just being a human being.
What's up with Gatling? You know, the guy that. Who was the only guy he couldn't beat. And I'm pretty sure Justin, he was in the 2004 Olympics. That's a long, that's a long
stretch,
time ago. To think though,
of course,
that
he's very controversial, unfortunately. With his,
them supplement boys. Yeah. It's not even controversy. He was banned for doing steroids.
He was.
Twice.
It's an interesting the fact that he can still compete. And
do you think Bolt...
There's always going to be a question mark and a bit of an asterisk, isn't there? Because at the end of the day, you cheated.
Yeah, it has to be an... Every high-level sport, man, where we are in our day and age of medicine, nutrition, subs, tech, it's kind of like it probably shows up in every sport, you think?
Yeah, I'm sure everyone, you know, touches that boundaries, you know what I mean? And I guess there's unexpected things that comes. Like, 2 or 5 years ago, you would have no one thought Lance Armstrong was what he ended up being. And unfortunately, it's taken away from the credibility of what he's achieved. Same as John Jones.
So. Yeah. Oh, my God. How dare you open up that window of John Jones. Heartbreaking. I think Lance, though, is a perfect example of the whole sport. Did you watch Icarus?
No, I haven't.
Guys, there's an awesome documentary on Netflix, ICARUS. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. But it's about the cycling sport and how the blood doping EPO. I think with Lance, it was one of these things. He didn't look like a world beater physically. Because the things that he was taking, the EPOs, were just
he's
a
lot. Come back from testicular cancer and things like
that.
Yeah,
he had them boys.
It's pretty crazy.
But, Aaron McKenzie's going to bring definitely a new dynamic and hopefully open up some important conversations about mindset and mental health. regarding to, you know, taking your life, career, personal relationships to the next level.
For sure. Guys, just before we get Aaron on the show, big thank you for tuning in and, you know, sharing our stuff on social media. It's the best way we can grow the show. So please subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. And it's really important, if you do have a bit of time, just to leave us those reviews on iTunes.
And guys, it means a lot to Tristan and myself as well when we get messages on our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook from people who have listened to episodes and then proactively have taken the time to comment and give us feedback. You know, that's why we keep doing this.
Yeah, so big thank you. But in the meantime, here is Aaron McKenzie. Right, our special guest is Aaron McKenzie. Aaron is a two-time Olympic gold medalist at the 2008 and 2012 Summer Olympics, where she competed in rowing in the women's eights. She graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, and was a member of the 2005-2006 NCAA Division I Rowing Championships. She's a co-founder of Power Speed Endurance, and she's a highly sought-after coach. I welcome Aaron McKenzie.
Oh, thanks. You guys did your homework.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, Aaron, thanks for stopping by the show, you know, sharing the space with Tristan and I. You know, like he said, Olympian, you're a coach. I've been writing a lot about recovery, specifically with my clients on a commercial gym basis. So having you on the show, I wanted to start off with maybe before we get to the recovery aspect, more training through injuries. I know that, you know, a lot of high volume routines, a lot of us sometimes lose the connection with our own bodies. Like maybe we push ourselves too far or not far enough. What's your insights on that?
Yeah, I think it's almost, you know, it's the nature of the beast of wanting to engage in a sport for, you know, whether it's for play or for, you know, it's paying your bills that you, and I think it also depends on what sport you're in. But from what I've seen, my world was the endurance side. And suffering is an art, like it is. And I guess you could say suffering, I heard a definition the other day. It's like, you know, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Mm. So you could say pain is, you know, definitely an art to dealing with that. So you don't have to suffer as much. But it is an all too present thing within, you know, physical activities. And that's how you change, that's how you evolve, that's how you get better, is how do you deal with that pain, whether it's that split second, you know, sitting at the bottom of the squat and you're questioning yourself, you're like, oh, does it feel good? Do I really want to stand up? Or is it like, you know, 3 hours in and you're like, I totally fueled wrong. What am I going to do now? You know, and yeah. So I think, yeah, it is the art of dealing with pain, and probably not necessarily suffering, and not making it suffering.
Yeah. Aaron, pain, yeah. Like, were you always like that as a youngster? Because before you rode, were you a dancer or gymnast? Which one did you do before you actually rode?
I wish I was a gymnast. They kicked me out of the gymnast class. I was a anomalies. That was just, yeah, I don't think I've grown since I was in fifth grade, you know.
I've been grown since second grade.
Too much milk or something. But anyhow, yeah, no, I was a big kid. They could kick me out of gymnastics. But yeah, I was just this tall, lanky girl, and I did classical ballet for 12 years.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot with, you know, various athletes, and it seems that combat athletes, specifically the MMA fighters and boxers, will share a common insight of never going into the fight 100% healthy. It's always like, you know, they're carrying like lingering injuries and not ever being like at their full 100%. Is this something that you'd had to struggle with rowing? Is that a sport to where, because it's a lot of energy expenditure all the time, and I've never done it. So I was wondering if you could, you know, one of those things
you never sat on the lovely concept too, rowing machine.
Oh, and that's, is it just that?
No.
Yeah, I mean, didn't assume.
Another dynamic of like sitting on the water and balancing, but you get the experience of like, you know, questioning your every stroke.
And the common injuries there, they're like, do you struggle with like joint or ribs? I heard that you struggled through like, was it a rib injury?
Is that, and it's,
five too many broken ribs. But the most common injury I think is probably still back, spinal, disc. Everybody has bulging, disc in rowing. If you don't, then you probably haven't rowed long enough. my old mentor Kelly and even my husband Brian would kill me for saying that. They're like, no, position over purpose, they're position junkies. But I think, injuries are part of the sport, and that are, if you're never getting injured, you never really know what your limits are. And so, that was, hindsight is always 2020, but that's how I look at it now. Like, dude, those were a blessing, because if I was always in the safe zone, I don't think I would have ever made it, nor would I have taken as much interest in the sport or in the challenge of it, and wanting to find a different or a better way to get better, to move better. It's just your nature's way of telling you, pay attention. So I don't think, as much as everybody's trying to move perfectly, only do good reps, have the perfect training plan, like the super secret, like squirrel training plan.
Yeah.
It's all good. And as long as you're learning from it, you don't need to be perfect, because you just need to be open to learning from your experiences. And sure, injured sucks. And especially when you can't do anything at all. You're just so dependent on that dopamine hit that, every day to just ward off, the demons that you're running from. I think injuries are a good thing. Mm. They make us feel human, and remind us that we're human.
Absolutely.
I think we also kind of like feeling a bit of pain, maybe before a competition, because especially with fighters, like knowing that they're going to go in and it is going to be painful. They're like, the hardest part is typically starting. If you don't remember what that feeling's like, you're like, you have this automatic reaction of like, oh, it's going to be bad. And then once you get into it, you're like, oh, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, or like I made it out to be. So maybe that there is the strategy to having something that you can feel in your shoulder or whatever. And then, hey, here's a distraction. I just got hit in the eye and my eyes burst open, but at least you're like, oh, this is familiar. This is something I remember. And it's not as scary as I think it is.
Yeah. Aaron, when you're in the boat with, your teammates, seven other girls, and you're all, competing and trying to get towards one goal, when you hit that breaking point in the actual event, like in the actual boat, do you guys talk to each other a lot and motivate each other? Like, is there no talk at all in there?
Yeah, I think it's definitely team to team, boat to boat. Everybody has their communications. But our crew, we can't forget the ninth seat, which is who is actually one of my really good friends on the team. She was the coxswain, and probably the hardest seat to make because there's only one. But she was a master at reading people and talking and communicating. And so we just, and the two boats that I raced at the Olympics, she was my coxswain for both of them. She retired and I was like, all right, I'm out. But you're hauling around this 110-pound girl, and she has a microphone, and then there's also a speaker right, down by your feet. So this is the voice of, God, this is what you actually want to be hearing or don't want to be hearing during the race. So we pretty much were quiet, especially during a race. There's definitely, it's, as Brian, my husband, would say, we were a pack of sharks. But, we're all synced up on the same cycle, from living and training together, so during training, there was definitely some back and forth, but we're all just in it to, we're all in it for the same goal. And I think at the end of the day, that was what we always came down to, was like, hey, I honestly would never have wanted to race any of my teammates on the international scene, because I knew what they were capable of. I would much rather go out and race, you know, another country, because I'm like, okay, they can't be as like scary or as good as this girl, because this girl's fucking crazy, you know. Like, yeah. So as much as, and that's I think something you always see those like bathroom posters about rowing and like teamwork, you know, it's like the ultimate teamwork, and it is. But I think the big misnomer is that like, when you're in a boat or you're on a team with somebody, you're best friends with everybody for life, you know, and you guys get along really well. And I think, you know, I hate to burst anybody's bubble, but we weren't best friends. We just respected the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
A lot of times we didn't hang out, you know, with each other outside of work.
Is that important, Erin?
What's that?
Is that important that you didn't hang out to give each other a bit of space?
For some of us, yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. And, you know, we're only human. And for who knows what reason, we like to criticize others and, you know, complain about shit all the time. Yeah. It's just super natural, especially when you're under stress.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, like, you know, what's going on? Somebody else's fault. You have to deflect. But, yeah, at the end of the day, like, as long as you can respect the other person, it obviously didn't affect our goal in the end. So,
yeah, Erin, with the, you know, outside of the boat, your strength and conditioning, you know, while you were preparing for the Olympics 2008, and this was before CrossFit for you, correct?
And actually, my brother introduced me to Kelly Sturrett, who's introduced me to CrossFit.
Yeah,
down the line. That was in the fall of 2007. So like by the hair of my chinny chin chin, I was like, okay, I need a plan. So yeah, I actually was doing some, you know, CrossFit-esque workouts, before 2008.
Yeah. So before that though, what was your training like in comparison to once you started doing the methodologies of CrossFit? Could you share with us like the differences in your strength and conditioning before CrossFit and after?
Oh yeah. I was just hammering. I was more is better. I guess I don't know any different because I've never been or can't remember being in any other body, but I think I have like a freaky ability to recover. So I like to sleep and I'm a really good sleeper. Potentially that's my superpower.
Great superpower.
You know, other people are like fast or like, you know, invisible and shit, but I just sleep really well. So I was able to just add on mileage to the typical, you know, at that time, I would say we were doing anywhere from like 120 to 140K a day, not a day, gosh, that would be awful, but a week. Okay. And so that would be, you know, doing a 20,000 meter row in the morning and then come back and, you know, sometimes we'll do a strength and conditioning session or, you know, it was pretty much maintenance. And then come back later in the afternoon and do another 12K row. So they were pretty heavy training sessions, but still I was like, okay, I'm smaller. I came in at the end of a training cycle. So the Olympics, you know, every 4 years I came in, there was 2 years left of the cycle, before selection. So I was like, I need to play catch up. I was just adding on so much volume, just sitting on freaking erg or even getting another girl to go out in the water with me. So it was mostly just rowing and sitting on the erg and just rowing a lot. But it was, it was pretty much insanity because I continued to break myself every 6 months.
Wow.
So that was a good game plan till it didn't work.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, Erin, I've heard you speak about being undersized. You're about 175 centimeters tall. Typically, for a female, what's the typical size?
My imperial measurement knowledge is totally off. But,
I think that's 5'9".
I was asking Tristan. I was like, 177 centimeters. But I think it would be like, are you 5'8" or 5'9"?
5'9".
I am 5'9".
Okay, yeah, 5'9".
That's an argument. You know, my coach actually had this like famous quote where somebody was like trying to ask about me and he was like, laughed. He was like, yeah, she'll tell you she's 5'9", but she's definitely not you know, smidge over 5'8". I'm like,
you at MX's, don't you?
But yeah, no, I swear that's what the doctor, you know, that's what it said at the freaking doctors. But fine.
Yeah.
Fine. And then the girls are typically, I think there even is a advertisement now, or not even advertisement, but it's like standard. You have to be at least 5'11" be considered. So, you know, that's only a few inches, but the average height was in my boat was about 6'1", 6'1.5".
Wow.
So I, what's the conversion there?
Yeah. So how do you, you know, that is like, for example, I'll probably use Drew Brees for an example. Like, he's an undersized quarterback giving up 4 or 5 inches, and it does. You play quarterback, it does make a huge difference. In terms of, like, that advantage they have over you, like, what was your equalizer?
It was, a little bit of crazy.
sleep?
Yeah, I sleep, exactly. But I honestly think I kind of looked at it and had help kind of breaking down what was rowing. Rowing is a strength endurance sport, right? And so for that, you know, I was actually just trying to explain this to one of my athletes the other day. Like, power is force times distance over time, right? So if I can't increase my distance, that's fixed, right? I can always, you know, try to sacrifice my position to get a little bit more distance, but I just call that like cheap distance, right? Because you're at in the end, it'll kick you in the butt. So I can't increase my distance. I can increase my force, right? And so that's what I worked on is, you know, in figuring out how to be pound for pound stronger than anybody else out there. And so that's why, you know, CrossFit, which I think that they brought it to the forefront of like, vary it up. Like, what is your goal? Like, obviously I did not need to do a lot of CrossFit WODs. Like, I did not need to do more conditioning. But what I did do was, you know, 5x5s, sets of threes, just always building up to like a couple heavy doubles. And I would add that into my training, once I really figured it out. And that was my understanding of CrossFit. I think it's kind of gotten a little jaded and gray, and that people think it's only those like crazy hero wads, you know? Mm. And I'm like, well, if that's the whole, if you're not challenging yourself that way, then yeah, that should be your CrossFit. But that's, you know, also what you kind of see on the screen is it's like constantly varied. You have to do everything. But I'm like, hey, do what you enjoy and then fill in the holes with what you don't have in your day to day. And, you know, it can't hurt being an all around athlete.
Yeah. We were interviewing, a legendary bodybuilder, Frank Zane, and he's in his mid-70s now. And I asked Frank, you know, he still coaches, he still does seminars, he's still very active. And I asked him, what is his, you know, point of difference where a lot of guys he used to compete with, you know, maybe, you know, you can't even find him anywhere. And he said it was recovery. He said, you know, the modes of recovery for him, he would do a lot of meditation and then sensory deprivation, getting in the float tanks. With such high volume and, you know, high energy expenditure in your training styles, could you share with us, you know, some forms of recovery that you may do?
Sleep.
are you not into acupuncture? Do you get a lot of body work done?
Yeah, no, I did. with injuries, I know everybody would think like, you know, like, oh, you're just an ostrich. You're just like putting your head in the sand and just making it. But you just, I mean, it's the same thing with a kid. Like, dude, if they're like totally waxed, just have them go take a nap, you know? I think sleep is the ultimate recovery. And I feel like so bad for people who have like, you know, either a disorder or some, you know, it can't get it because it is just like gives you, it's the way for your mind to rest and give yourself a new perspective, and regenerate, you know, everything, ultimately relax. And I think meditation definitely, from what I know and understand, is the second best thing to sleep. Just practicing, just clearing your mind and letting everything just feel present. I didn't do all too much meditation, or at least what I thought was you know, meditation. I would literally, you know, before some races or big tests, I would lay in bed and just be there. Even if I wasn't sleeping, I would just try to like melt into the bed, which I suppose now that I think about it, that is pretty much meditation, right? You know, just clear your head. But when I had really bad, you know, aches and pains, I would definitely do acupuncture. I do not understand it one bit, but all I know is that, like, it's the same thing. Like, if you have the intention that it will work, it's going to work. And so I would always go in and, you know, it was almost a time to just rest and regenerate. And then, you know, you're giving yourself time to feel better. Yeah, again, I don't know how a pin in my ear is actually going to help my hip, but I, you know, there's some things that you don't have to know, and it's almost better that you don't, because, actually one of my favorite books is this, old book. It was the first present Brian ever gave me, actually, my husband, called Biology of Belief. And basically he just breaks it down and how there is a placebo effect, if you will. But how your belief, you know, there is no such thing as, you know, nature versus nurture. It's nature and nurture. That there's a protein, you know, sure, you have this DNA to be the fastest burner in the world, but if you don't give it the environment, it's never going to realize itself. And so if you believe, you know, if you don't give yourself the chance to, or the opportunity to recover, that's one thing. But also if you don't, you know, have all of your belief that you are recovering, that's, I think that's just as powerful as going to a massage or acupuncture or sleeping or whatever. It's like the intention that you are recovering, that you are, you know, regenerating is just as powerful.
Yeah, so like believing in the system that you're following is a huge part of, like, you know, believing that you're going to succeed. Back to the sleep thing. Are you familiar with Dr. Sean Stevenson?
No.
But he's an expert on sleep. And was this something that you got very scientific about? Like, he writes about the circadian rhythm in terms of, like, the idea that we need 8 hours is kind of like not true. It's more about the window of when we do fall asleep and then the quality of sleep while we're sleeping. Like he said, from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. is a kind of a critical window. If you could fall asleep in those hours equate to like times two.
Yeah, no, I, again, like I said, I think that's my superpower.
So it was never like science-based. You weren't tracking your sleep. It was like you were just aware that you needed the rest.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was like the thing that I like just had the major feels on. I was like, okay, I'm not even going to engage any further. I'm just going to go, rest and be by myself. Okay.
Yeah.
Some people were like track everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for some people that might help, but I do also do see this obsession over it. And, you know, it's almost like chasing a freaking butterfly. And the more you want to go grab it, you know, the more it'll run away from you instead of just being still and letting it come to you. But yeah, no, that there's a friend of ours, Ian Denikin, who is a PhD out in Australia. He's actually done some interesting work on sleep, fighting athletes. And I think potentially service members too. But yeah, I find all of that stuff extremely fascinating. The reason I hooked up with him is because he has these theories on how to adjust to time zones for traveling athletes, or, you know, even if you're a working professional and like you need to be on point the next day, like what's the best way to prepare before you even travel to get onto that time zone so you are, on point.
Yeah. Aaron, just with managing stress and, you know, as Johnny just mentioned with recovery, you know, during your Olympic period, did you have to like work for a living while you actually trained and recovered and all that sort of things?
Fortunately, once I first joined the team, yeah, I did. I was at a commodities firm. funnily enough. I think I was just like an executive assistant type, but yeah. I spent a lot of time sleeping underneath the desk. yeah, I think it's safe to tell them that now it's like, you know, 10 years away, but yeah, no, it was just like, I did that for a year. I was totally over my limit because I was continuing to get injured. And then so finally my parents were like, okay, we'll help pay your rent and food. This is what you want to do.
Yeah.
And the next year was the Olympic year. Typically nobody really works during that Olympic year because the volume goes up, the stress goes up.
Yep.
And, you know, there are some guys, on the men's team, their coach, Mike Tatey, who's actually the men's coach again now, but he had this theory, you know, that was good. It created balance, in your life, and you needed that. And a lot of them did it, and did it very well, balancing a job. Typically they're like eye bankers, economic firms, yeah. Like crazy ass jobs too. And then, you know, being on the U.S. Olympic team. But it was not a common thing in the women's team. Nor was, sponsorship a common thing. Mm. So we were masters at, living at or below the poverty line, and just we fortunately had a great network that some of the locals helped us with finding host families. Mm. Like my the Cox and my friend Mary Whipple and I hooked up with this sweet deal with this house that was in Architectural Digest. The family just went to France with their two kids because they wanted them to do like a year abroad. But they wanted somebody to watch their house. And so we're like, oh, we'll do that.
Sounds pretty good.
<You know? laughs>
Yeah.
So yeah, that was definitely helpful. So then all of your, you know, funds or whatever, which was anywhere from 400 to typically, I think most I got paid was 1600 a month, went to food and also recovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brian mentioned we brought up, Holly Holm and how you're a fan of, like, he went down there for the UFC event and he mentioned that he met her. And I wanted to ask you, because I saw on your Insta, you put a post about you were in a rolling, doing jiu-jitsu. Are you belted?
Yeah.
Are you belted, or is it something that you do for fun? How long have you been doing it? And share some insights on that.
Yeah, that was probably the hardest sport the least like talented I've ever felt.
Humbling.
I think it was extremely humbling because I was so used to just being able to turn my head off. And yeah. I think if I get more into it, I will be able to get to that place, but it's just been so long, where I've had to put in the repetitions. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different dynamic things, and you're not just working with this, boat or an erg that you know is predictable. Like, you know what's going to happen. Like, if you push your hips to the right, it's going to go to the left, you know, and, or if you, you know, step on the footboard a little bit harder, you know what's going to happen to your numbers. Playing with another person where you have no idea. And I know that I have long story. I have not been rolling since. I started just literally on those like what the fuck moments where I'm like, I'm not doing anything. I need to like be a student again.
Mm.
When we were still down in Southern California. But yeah, we moved up to Oregon the beginning of February, and then I just haven't found a place to do it here. But whenever we go down south, we go back and roll at Art of Jiu-Jitsu. Found this excellent teacher. He does, I think, pretty much fundamentals only. Mm. And it's a good reason why, you know, it's typically like the smarter professors usually are teaching the 101, right?
Yeah.
He just has an amazing way of communicating, but I felt like such a doofus because I'm like, you know, please, I hope they don't know who I am. Like, please don't mention anything about me being athletic because I was like flailing, but I got a stripe on my white belt.
Wow.
So before I left, I know. So that was pretty huge. But yeah, no, I would have to start way back over. you know, dabbled a little bit in Muay Thai as well. Hmm. Kind of like that better.
Shrinking.
It just, it's a bit faster. I don't know. It just felt a little bit more natural.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
Yeah. Aaron, what's it like? So, for example, when you retired and you pulled out the rowing from your, like, day-to-day training, how did your body respond?
Like shit. yeah. No, and this is something that, you know, I hate being stuck on it because it's like, oh, poor you. You know, you went and got 2 golds, like, and you were able to, like, go party with, like, the who's at the Olympic Village. But, yeah, I think it's something that nobody really wants to say or, you know, I'm even embarrassed to say it, but, like, there's a gnarly drop-off. And I think part of it, sure, is the, you know, hey, you're no longer in the spotlight or you're no longer doing something great or special anymore. But I do think that there's something hormonally more so than just psychologically. And it could, like we were saying, biology of belief, it could be a little combination of both. But, yeah, no, I went and got blood tests, hormone tests. Like, I was sure something was happening. Like, I was like, oh my, like, I'm so unhealthy. Like, what's going on?
What were the things making you think you were unhealthy though? Was it more of a feeling or was it you were putting on weight?
Yeah, no, I wasn't putting on weight. I like just had this awful feeling. I couldn't sleep enough. I couldn't like, I wasn't motivated to do anything. I mean, I guess, you know, the common term would probably be depression, but it was like, it was just, I think that, you know, it was obviously something that came, that I know other, and then talked to numerous other teammates, and other professional athletes that have it in the form of more anxious symptoms. And these are some of the most like high functioning, like Ivy League, smartest freaking people, you know, working at, you know, Fortune 500 companies. Like I didn't go straight off into a job or you know, school or anything right after. So it's like, hey, they went and did something great again. And we're continuing to get this positive, you know, reinforcement, but still they were suffering from these like really harsh demons. And so I don't know. I think that's kind of my journey, right now is to figure that out. And I think I've, you know, come a long way, from 2012, hopefully. but yeah, no, it was like, I couldn't laugh. I couldn't smile. Like it was fucking awful. And you see a lot of athletes. I was actually just talking to a coach right now who's a college coach. And he's like, yeah, I see this with my senior athletes all the time. And a lot of them turn to alcohol. You know, that's the whole Michael Phelps thing. And it's like, they just want to feel. And maybe it is like this going away from that feeling of pain that we were talking about initially. Like maybe that became so comfortable is when you're no longer able to give yourself physical pain, then you start to create mental pain.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I was reading a piece by a guy named Sebastian Junger, and he was writing about so are you familiar with like Restrepo?
Yeah.
The bit where he was talking about a lot of these soldiers were coming home and from these war torn areas and they were getting depressed, but he was saying how it wasn't the depression that you would think, it was more that because they were separated from their their family, like the other soldiers. How much of that, of like, you know, the mindset, the depression of once you stopped your career in rowing, was it because you didn't have your team with you, do you think? Or was it just like, you know, the sport coming to an end, or just the camaraderie?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a piece of that. Like the, there's truth to that as well. I think that, you know, there's thankfully so many resources for veterans, and transition, for veterans, because it is like, you know, that's the ultimate sacrifice. And a lot of these, a lot of them go into the service straight out of high school, you know, and then they retire when they're, you know, 30, 40, and it's just like, shit, now what? No. And I was actually having a good conversation with Brian about this earlier today, but he was like, you know, maybe it is this psychological development process that you didn't have because you were getting things taken care of for you, or more so, you were given orders of what to do, so you didn't really have to think for yourself. And I think that, I don't know, that kind of put my lid. I was like, huh, maybe, you know, maybe that is, there's some truth to that too, of like, you know, that you didn't actually develop the ability to be confident in your own decisions and actually know who you are, because it was like, oh, I have this coach telling me this is good, this is bad, do this, don't do this. Mm. And I have full faith in them. And I have my faith in my ability to perform when ready, but like outside of that, like I don't know who the fuck I am.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I think there's something to that too as well.
Aaron, what's it like when you're standing on the podium with a gold medal around your neck?
Yeah, what's that like?
To be on to happier topics. I think, you know, with all that said, if someone was asked me, like, would you do it again, even if you knew that you would be like shit for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and I'd be like, hell yeah, I would do it again, you know. But to be honest, standing on the podium for me wasn't the most exciting part of it all. It was actually like, and I actually watch videos of or have seen videos. I don't watch them like every night, but you know, like when I go to a, I just replay it every night.
Every night, the same one.
Yeah. I don't know why I have these issues.
Yeah. With a candle lit.
Aaron, do you ever wear your medals?
Oh, no.
Could you imagine?
I would.
You taunt Brian with them? You have them hanging like taunting? Yeah, I would do that.
I would do it.
Slap across the face. And you know, they have the saying, like, once an Olympian, always Olympian. But always, but I also think the truer part is, like, never rest on your laurels.
Mm.
And I think that is something that I hope to, like, help with this transition of, like, hey, this was a great experience. It's almost like the man on the moon syndrome, right? Like, you, like, reach the moon when you're in your 20s and, you know, but when you're in your 30s or 40s, like, you can... you're no longer fit enough to be an astronaut, so you can't go to the moon anymore. So what's next? Like, cool. Like I've been to the moon, but now what, you know? I try not to like make that as much my identity as like, it's been a piece of my progression. I don't think it's not even, I think, I truly believe it's not the greatest thing that I have done or will ever do. Mm. Because, you know, sure, it has inspired a lot of people, and I went on a journey and, you know, dealt with a lot of pain and figured out how to get really good at it. But I think that there is a way to, you know, do help more people than just by, you know, scoot down your butt fast. Backwards.
and with these experiences that you've been fortunate enough to have lived through, and looking back when you were competing, if you could go back and maybe some advice that you probably needed that you never received that you know now, what sort of advice would that be to your younger self, like during your competitive career?
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm thinking, like, you know, I just wish there was more times where I could remind myself like how fortunate I was, and to actually, I know, play, yeah. Like continue to have fun with it. I took it, I literally was reading, you know, all the Navy SEAL novels, like all these like stories about recons and whatever. Like I felt like I was at war. Like wow. I took it so freaking seriously. Like I was just like, before a race or before a big test, I was like, hey, today's a good day to die. Like I'm not afraid of like pain. That was like almost the place that I had to go convince myself like to not stop when it, you know, my mind told me to stop. It was like, it was, you know, hey, your life's on the line. Yeah. You ready? You know?
Yeah, it's interesting.
So I think it would be to play, because I think, you know, sometimes you see some athletes out there that do that, and they come out the other side much better. They're like, hey, that was fun, you know?
Yeah.
Winning was fun at the end, but it was like the preparation was freaking war, at least in my head.
Yeah. Aaron, did you go on Oprah?
Yes, I was in the crowd at Oprah.
I thought you, because I read somewhere that, did she contact you guys after you won or something?
Yeah, I think it was all the medalists in 2008.
Wow.
She had over there.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, she is, she's definitely, you can sense it like with her energy. She's definitely an anomaly. And it's just a really crazy, like she'll make anybody feel special. It was actually the same way that fortunately after winning the NCAAs, we were invited to the White House. Wow. And even though he wasn't a fan favorite, met George Bush, George W. And I remember going in and you could feel when he walked in, and he was the cheeriest, like fun-loving guy, just cracking jokes, and you're just like, well, no wonder people are like, you know, standing behind you. And so there's just that factor where, you know, these people come into a room. I mean, I guess you can call it charisma, if you will. But it's the energy that was kind of cool that I sensed with him and with Oprah and a couple other people who are, you know, fortunate to be around. But it's like, you know, you can see why people are following them around all everywhere. Mm. Oh, how can I get some of that, you know?
From the nutrition side of things, we were talking earlier, your transition from like, you know, being a high level competitive athlete when that came to an end. I'm sure that there was also a transition to like how you were living your day to day with your lifestyle, like your daily caloric intake when you're doing all these kilometers in the water would have to be super high. When you stopped, did you notice that you had to adjust a lot of things in your day to day meals, stuff like that? You guys have like nutritionists?
Like 200 or something. Oh yeah, we had. Hopefully the USOC listens to this, but we had some pretty bad nutritionists. For instance, there's one of my teammates who went to lightweight, which means you have to be a certain. You can only be, a certain weight to race.
Yeah.
It's like fighting. You have to weigh in, but they have to weigh in the morning of, and wow. So you can't do all like the dehydration, rehydration type of stuff. But anyhow, one of them basically told her to eat bread because it was the lightest thing she could eat.
Oh, wow. What? What year, like, what year was that?
Oh, this was this last cycle.
It's crazy.
Shit. Yeah, no, it was this last cycle. I think it was like right after 2012. And so she actually, you know, I had talked to her. After that, she was like, okay, thank you, and like walked out the door. And I was like, all right, so let's talk about some other options here. We did get some advice. I'm sure some of it was good advice, but obviously the bad advice sticks out more. I did a lot of reading and research and played around with, you know, paleo and low carb and keto, and it was just, I think it, you know, what it came to at the end was, I think it was just a sense of control that I was looking for, because I continued to do those diets and play around with them, you know, and be my own experiment afterwards. So I didn't gain a lot of weight because I was still just, you know, chasing, as my husband and I lovingly call it, chasing the dragon. And it was like, oh, you know, I'm supposed to be this physical specimen, so I need to eat clean and I need to do this. But now my whole experiment is to like, okay, now do I feel really different? Or am I just, you know, thinking it's different because some other guy said he felt different, you know? Yeah. And so that was the big thing with, I noticed, what was it? I think it was like 2014. I did keto. I went into ketosis. And I was just like, yeah, you know, I'm like so skinny and lean. And I like, you know, my abs are sticking out and that felt like great. And then
Aaron, what does it feel like to be in ketosis?
Yeah, what does it feel like? We were supposed to talk to Dom this morning, D'Agostino, and you bring it up.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What does it feel like?
Well, there's this thing called ketogenic flu. So it's the same, like, it doesn't feel so hot. You, like, can't think. You're cranky. You're, like, you feel like you're coming down with the flu.
Yeah.
But it's your body basically weaning, you know, itself off of the sugars and whatnot. But once you're past that, you're like, oh, this is fine. Like, figure out how to eat cheese sticks or whatever, you know, and meat for the rest of my life. For women, I mean, I know there you guys probably have a huge male contingency, but for women, we have this cheat litmus test of whether we're healthy or not, and it's, you know, our cycle or our period, and I lost mine, and it was just like,
wow.
Okay, this is probably not the healthiest thing for me, and you know, I think, who was it, Dr. Andy Galpin put out this thing.
It was on DeFranco this week.
He was just on Joe too.
Yeah.
Or Rogan.
Yeah.
And Brian worked with him.
He's a popular guy these days.
Yeah, he's everywhere.
He went to some conference and basically, you know, it was like, hey, you know, you would never prescribe the same diet or nutrition plan for someone, for, you know, the same person, nor would you want to prescribe that to someone for their entire life. And the same thing would apply to a training plan. Like, why would you want to prescribe the same training plan for someone for their entire life, right? So I think we should, you know, play around with it, ebb and flow. And then also, most importantly, figure out how to listen to ourselves and see if, hey, does this actually work for me, you know? You know, I think Dom has done a lot of research on it, on ketosis and, there's so much research out there, but all I know is how I feel, really.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people kind of forget how to listen to that. They're like, oh, but the research says I should feel good, you know? But yeah, basically, that's been my transition now. It's like, okay, what if I eat bread? Am I going to feel like shit? You know, cause I would not touch bread or gluten for heaven's sake, you know, with a 10-foot pole. I was like, oh, it's so bad. It like eats up your gut and makes you stupid, you know, all these things.
Yeah.
And it makes you fat. But like, hey, I've like reintroduced it. Like, and I don't eat it every day. But like, you know, Brian actually makes a mean like sourdough loaf. We've like fermented our own. Created our own. I forget what you call it, like the mother. But like without the yeast, like you can actually, sourdough is actually not that bad for you because it creates, you know, the necessary enzymes to break down the gluten.
Yeah.
But I was like, huh, like, I'm not like crapping my pants. I don't feel that stupid, I think, you know, like, and it's, it's very interesting. I think, you know, you gotta, that also ebbs and flows. Like right now, Brian's been experimenting with this, FODMAP diet. You guys heard of that?
What is it called?
FODMAP?
No.
There are just certain types of food that have either high glucose or either like fermenting properties that some people just can't digest or eat. And so he's taken it all out and he's like, holy shit, my shit is so much better, you know? Wow. And that's, you know, we have a, intern, our doctor is basically, that was what he said. You know, he's like, hey, you can tell anybody's health by their shit, you know, or anybody's demeanor. You can be a psychologist and it's like, hey, how's your shit? Like, is it all over the place? Okay. How do you feel? All over the place? Oh, that's weird. You know? So I think it, yeah, no, we don't need to talk about poop that much, but, I just find it interesting because it's like, all right, you know, there's the male litmus test, I guess, since you guys don't get to bleed out, you know, 7 days out of the month or 5 days out of the month, you guys can just look at your poop.
No, yeah. I had a friend's mother who beat cancer twice because she said she would always notice her poop, and she knew like what, as it would change what that meant. And so she caught cancer twice super early because of that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
That's heavy.
And then, yeah, I read one of my buddies I went to high school with, he just posted that he lived for 2 years without going to the doctor with his poo having like a mucus membrane around it. And he thought it was just normal. And he, wow. And that's a sign of colon, prostate issues, specifically cancer, you know, so that's it's very important. Yeah. We have this taboo about things coming out of our bodies, but it's like,
I know, right?
It's probably telling us something for sure.
Exactly.
Aaron, you know, we've spoken about Brian quite a number of times now. In terms of Brian teaching you things in terms of performance, what do you think the biggest thing that he's brought into you, both your training and, you know, competing as well?
Brian has his superpower is his ability to adapt. He is super sensitive to feeling and like his own body. And he is definitely open to, you know, experimenting and changing, a lot of things. But I think, you know, with that, I definitely think that's been one of the biggest things I've learned is to not just go hard all the time. Working, you know, you gotta take a step back. Like we said, even with, you know, like nutrition stuff, just take a step back and listen to how you feel. Is this working for you, or are you just, you know, believing it is because you want to be, you know, part of the hype or part of the trend? And you know, he's definitely a big disruptor, I think, because of that, because he likes to question the status quo or even look at it from a different viewpoint. But yeah, no, it's kind of funny because I think we're the yin and the yang. Like, yeah. I find so much comfort in just going hard and just like putting the blinders on and just like hammering. And I'm like, hey, you know, if there's pain, great, like bring it on. But for him, like he is able to learn from that. Like that's why he was such, you know, and is such a great teacher and a coach, because he knows how to like communicate and avoid, to help other people avoid pain, you know, like with running or with like breathing. It's like, hey, you know, you're feeling a little bit off or you aren't recovering, you can probably figure that out with your breathing pattern. And so let's like experiment with it. And I'm really super proud of him and like how deep he's gone with it. Because at first it was just like, let me just breathe like all the air. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try it too. Like let's go breathe all the air. And I would just keep on going through and I would literally end up in like the fetal position afterwards. You're supposed to do this in the morning and get your breathing ready. And I would end up in the fetal position and like want to go back to bed. And here he's like, I am so charged. I want to take over the world. And I was like, I think I'm doing it wrong. What's going on? But you know, I did like the 12-week program or whatever it was. And actually, I don't think I made it 12 weeks. I think it was like finally week 9 after putting up with this pain of like, I feel like shit, you know, like what's going on. And like looking at him and like all these guys he has like huffing and puffing. I'm like, it's so fun. Like let's breathe more. Finally he was like, oh, I think these breathing patterns have different effects on different people. And, like, you know, people have a different underlying demeanor. And if you are, you know, parasympathetic based and you get jacked up on adrenaline, you don't know how to deal with adrenaline as much. And for me, like, I love breathing hard as long as I have a physical outlet for it, you know. But, like, just sitting there and breathing, like, literally sent me to the shitter. And I, you know, talked to the, you know, some of the guys that created the whole, you know, breathing hard thing. And they're like, oh, you just got to let it go. Just go harder. But, you know, thankfully, Brian's, like, starting to kind of uncover, no, like, breathing is a very powerful tool that we can all use. But it's not one size fits all.
Yeah.
There is a lot of, and I think the yogis have known this for years, and I've, like, but just talked about it a little too foo-foo, like, and so yeah. You get this guy with, like, a bunch of tats and, you know, raspy voice talking about it. People are starting to listen now.
Now, Johnny, do we have any more questions before we hit personality?
I think let's do it.
Okay, we're going to hit the personality section. Johnny's got the first one.
Aaron, if... three of your best friends were sitting at a table and you weren't in the room, what sort of things would they be saying about you?
Oh, shit. Are they drunk? Are we drinking, or is this, like, after a workout? Probably that, yeah, she's just a little crazy. I think, yeah, pretty sure my friends think I'm a little, like, loco, and have, yeah, or just probably just because I can and like to go hard all the time. Three things. I don't know. Something else. We'll have to come back to it. I think that would be, for right now, that's the only thing I can really come up with, is that I'm a little crazy, maybe a little obsessive. I can thank rowing for that. You do the same thing over and over again a million times a day.
Yeah.
Yep. You get a little OCD.
Sure.
All right, Aaron, I'm going to take you back to your childhood. What posters did you have on your bedroom wall growing up?
I actually still have one hanging up in the garage. It's it was never in my bedroom because my mom wanted it to be very girly, but it was in the laundry room. And it was this picture of San Francisco Giants player Will Clark.
Yep, Will the Thrill.
Will the Thrill. There we go. But yeah, no, he you know, my mom was and is a super fan, and so grew up in the 80s when they were, you know, there's Will Clark, Robbie Thompson, Matt Williams. Like, these were my, like, sports heroes, because I didn't know if there was anything else besides baseball. Try it again. But yeah, no, it was San Francisco Giants, and he just intrigued me because he had this game face that, yeah, they called it the Nooshler, which who knows where that came from, but it was just, you know, it's a picture of him with, like, the Nooshler. It's just this, like, game face that, like, intimidated the pitchers or something. So that's the one that I've definitely hung on to.
All right, Aaron. And then how about for our listeners at home, some advice overcoming adversity on some bad days?
That's a good one. I think we're so caught up in changing our state and, like, you know, don't be sad, be happy all the time. Like, there's this whole, like, movement to, like, oh, be happy, happy, you know, like, do whatever you can to be happy, that we, like, don't honor having bad days or honor getting injured or, just even sometimes being a shitty person. But as long as you recognize it and you're like, all right. And I think for me, that has been the fastest way to almost get rid of it and change my state, is to almost honor and let it play out. And it's just like, hey, like, there's adversity. Don't fight it. Kind of like that butterfly thing, right? Just don't go chasing after it. Just, okay, there it is. This sucks, you know, like, and just kind of acknowledge it versus try to overcome it.
Yeah, some great advice. I haven't heard that one before. It's great.
To honor,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, I like it, to honor your bad days.
All right, Aaron, final question. You're going to be hosting a private dinner party. You've got 5 invites. Now, only rules, no family or friends, but it can be anyone, dead or alive. Who would you like to invite?
I'm actually listening to Dale Carnegie. I think he's a fascinating dude. Here'd be one I would like to talk to. No friends. One of my favorite people to just philosophize. Is that a word? talk to, I guess, but try not to be fancy, is actually our doctor, Dr. Major, Justin Major, who, if you try to find him, you probably won't, because he's probably one of the hardest guys to find, but he is, he's a good dude. It would be a good dinner date. I'm just going to come up with Jackie Joyner-Kersee. I ran into her in 2012. We started a conversation there, but she was just a joy. And anybody that can be coached by their husband, I would like to understand what goes on and how the hell that happened. I will invite her, and I guess we got 2 more seats. I don't know. I think it would just honestly be, I know it's illegal, but family and friends. Like, I would want them to join in on the conversation and kind of be a part of it as well. Because that's all it is. Like, we're all just relationships, right? And so even if people are dead or alive, you just want to come back and be able to be like, oh, did you remember that conversation? You know, if it's just me, then it's not going to be fun to talk about. Yeah. So.
All right. Before we let you go, Erin, we want everyone following Erin Instagram. She's Erin Cafaro. That's her maiden name. Cafaro. Twitter. She's the same handle. You can also find her online at powerspeedendurance.com. Now, Erin, you and Brian are going to be in Sydney for our Australian audience. September 20. It's a Saturday, correct?
30.
Or 30.
Yeah. I unfortunately don't get to go back down under, but Brian's going to be there. I got to spend a whole semester there. For some reason, my parents paid for a semester abroad, and I got to drink the shit out of myself.
Where did you live, Erin?
Up on the Gold Coast.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. The Goldie.
Wichita University.
Yeah.
Yep. You've got amazing parents.
Yeah, thanks, Mom.
You know what? I thought I was getting away with murder, but it was probably the smartest thing they did, because I am not fascinated in the least by alcohol after that. I was like, just drank myself into oblivion. But, it's a fun place.
Oh, it is.
It is a very, very fun place. There's the Sydney. I know the Sydney clinic is selling out pretty quickly, but New Zealand, they're coming to Auckland. That one, got to figure out how to get to that audience. I've spent a time in New Zealand too. Love that place. And I think that, there's such performance junkies down there too. Absolutely. So it would be cool to fill that one up. And then what's the other one? Brisbane, and Adelaide. So
we'll have all the details on the show notes for everyone.
Yep. Aaron, thanks a lot for sitting down with us and sharing the space with us.
Cool. Yeah, that was fun.
Johnny, that was Erin McKenzie.
Yeah, great interview, man. Another awesome insight, expert perspective on the mindset and the work ethic it takes to get to a certain level, and her perspective the highest.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one. Just little insights. I love talking to athletes, and just I think she's a little bit different. I do prefer retired athletes, because they are a lot more open about speaking about things like vulnerability and, remember what Cal told us in last week's interview? Every good story starts with a vulnerability.
Vulnerability.
So sometimes to get the best stories out of someone, you do need to show that sort of sides when you were down, or even when you're at the top of the world with 2 Olympic gold medals.
Yeah. Have you ever had Olympic aspirations when you were younger? Like, was this ever one of your goals?
Not really. I think
well, I was always around that footy circle and things like that. So footy was never going to be in the Olympic Games. I know rugby union is now in a sevens format, but
yeah,
I'm a big believer. Like, I think they're wrecking it a little bit. Like, I don't believe rugby sevens, especially when you consider they've taken, we spoke about last week about them taking out wrestling from the, that's the Olympic. That, you know, that's a great sport to have in the Olympics, I feel.
I think it's because it has so many different roots to other dimensions. Wrestling is the backbone of MMA, which is one of the fastest growing sports. Yeah. So you could, it's kind of,
I think the Olympics are just,
it's tragic.
They've gone into a corporate sort of mold where they're trying to think about where the most dollars can come from there. Some, obviously something like the rugby sevens, it's always going to be a sold out event around the world. It's one of the biggest events. So I think they've replaced it with a traditional sport where you might not have as big an attendance or viewership on the TV because obviously it's not as fast a sport. It's a different sort of mold. It's interesting. I would prefer to have like the traditional sports in there.
So share, you know, share some insights because I'm American. I've been here for 4 years. The rugby sevens, which is a new Olympic sport, that's not the rugby that they're playing, like Thurston plays in. That's a different sport altogether.
It's rugby union. So rugby union is a 15 a man side. So it's Wallabies. The Wallabies, the All Blacks. So obviously the All Blacks, I get what they're doing because, you know, the All Blacks are the most successful sport team in the history of sport. It's just the numbers. Really? The numbers don't lie. It's like,
you're referring to New Zealand's rugby union team.
Yeah.
Okay.
Their winning percentage is something like 97% or something.
I have to watch this.
It is something crazy.
Somebody else came up to me and asked me if I've seen this documentary. Have they done a documentary about the story franchise of like being a All Black?
Richie McCaw just came out with one.
There you go.
He was like one of the most famous captains for their team. He was captain for like the last 10 years or something like that. He's just one of the most famous players for the All Blacks. But
that's the haka, right?
Yeah, so that's their traditional war dance before they actually get on.
I watched a really, really it was a funny take on that in terms of traditions in sports.
Mm.
And it was the Americans men's basketball Olympic team playing New Zealand in an Olympic qualifier. And you have these huge personas like LeBron, Durant, Curry standing at half court looking at each other. They're all multi-millionaires. And they have this New Zealand team
doing
this dance. And the look on the American's face and the look on the New Zealand's face, you would think the New Zealanders were going to destroy them. They lost by 50.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like,
pump up.
Is there any place for that?
It kind of just it gives them that first kind of few minutes. I think it's a lot more intimidating on a rugby pitch than it would be on a basketball
court. I didn't know they did it for every sport. I thought it was just rugby.
Yeah. I think they're starting to do it across the whole.
Maybe they should just keep it to rugby where they're good at
it. I think it fits. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Probably got a point.
Like, why would you? You're going to get beat by 50. Is it really serving a purpose?
They've got one good player, that guy that plays for the Thunder. What's his name?
They have I don't know.
Yeah, the center that plays for Oklahoma. He's from New
Zealand.
He's
a New Zealander.
He's from New Zealand.
I had no idea.
That big guy, what's his name? Wow. I'll tell you.
Yeah, TK dropping bombs. Dude, I really didn't know. I know that Australia is represented really well in the NBA, and it's just getting better. You know, Delhi, you know, you guys still claim Kyrie, but the Young Bucks, Ben Simmons. Ooh, and while you're looking that
Laker
up. He's LSU kid. He's an Aussie? He's
strange.
Hold on.
Yeah, man.
Get out of here. Don Maker's an Aussie.
He's Australian. He immigrated when he was in his teens, I think, to Australia. So he's
Did Australian you grow up with basketball?
Yeah, absolutely. And
do you think that was because most people contribute that to that 92 Dream Team? You know, globalizing the sport, magnitude of Michael Jordan and Magic.
Absolutely. The effect they had in Australia. Like, in Australia in the early 90s,
yeah,
every venue was sold out.
Yeah,
we're talking about 10,000-15,000 seat stadiums in basketball getting sold out night after night.
For the NBL.
After night.
For our shows. Like,
yep.
I know you just chatted with Shane Hill on talking with TK.
Yeah.
Did you get to open the book up about, because he's older than us.
Much older.
Who were his, like, because they always say we can't raise the bar in anything until somebody has done it before. Before that 92 Olympic team, the world really didn't know that basketball could take place in countries like Australia. Because in the late 70s, did you have the sport? Was it popularized in Australia?
Yeah, it's always been around.
So who did that guy, Shane Hill, grow up, like, idolizing?
Shane, he was...
You know what I mean?
Like, Andrew Gaze was a big influence on him because they've got a bit of a... They played in the backcourt for Australia together.
How old is the NBL?
Ooh, Jesus.
Before the 80s?
Would be that. Maybe the 70s, maybe.
Oh, wow. Okay, because we've only had a team in Cleveland since the 70s. The Cavs did... Basketball didn't come to Ohio in the NBA until, I'm pretty sure it was 1977. So a country like Australia, who I was watching a documentary about the immigration boom, about when they had Paul Hogan doing the Australia ads in the mid 80s. And up until then, Americans really didn't come to Australia. They didn't really know about it. Yeah, they didn't really know about it. And then they
Steve Adams.
There you go. That's the center for OKC. Steve Adams. Does he play? Yeah. Does he start?
He's an all-star, man. There,
look at TK dropping balls. I wasn't aware, man. Like I said, I watched the Cavs. That's about it. But so you got New Zealanders in the NBA now. Yeah. Interesting, man. The sport is really globalized in terms of, you know, the reach.
Yeah, basketball's huge, man. I think for me, I grew up with a lot of Filipinos, and they love basketball, man. So I was kind of always just exposed to...
Did you ever play?
Oh, just on the court, just at lunchtime.
Did you see my Instagram story? Did you see my Instagram story? Were you basketball? No, I put... Dude, I'm the new place I moved into has a court there, and I played basketball every day.
Oh, I remember I saw that. It looked cool, that court.
Yeah, it's a little half court. It's a good place to shoot around. Maybe we could play some balls, play a game of horse. Well, we could play horse. You know who's the worst? The worst. Back to a conversation we just had with a strength and conditioning coach is Angus. He, for how strong, and he's the strongest dude in our gym, Olympic lift.
It doesn't replicate, does
there
it?
Is no finesse. There is no, you know, basketball is an artistic sport.
Actually, bringing back up to Shane. So Shane's big shot was his 3-point play. So if
he almost fought. Is this the guy who almost fought Barkley?
Yeah,
he fought Barkley though.
Yeah, he tried to fight Barkley. Yeah, and Vince Carter.
Talk to us about that.
Anyway, so if you have a look, if you YouTube the '96 warm up game between the Dream Team and the Aussies,
yeah.
Shane torched the Americans in the first quarter by hitting 30-foot three-point plays, and he did it 6 times.
So he was shooting bombs,
just bombs
from the logo.
They couldn't guard him. How do you guard someone that shoots from
33 feet, 34 feet?
And Lenny Wilkins is just going nuts on the sideline.
Dude, former Cavs coach, Hall of Famer, man, great coach there. So that's was that an Olympic qualifier? Was that a round game?
No, it was just – that's why it was so interesting that him and – so what happened was Barkley clipped him – when he was going for a three, he lands the three.
It was supposed to be a kind of a shoot-around sort of game.
Yeah, it was just an exhibition, just for them to get some practice legs before they started the real competition.
Yeah, and he was out there just draining bombs, just torching the U.S.
And then he was telling me a story about how Gary Payton was threatening to kill him. And
oh, the glove. GP, man, when he was in Seattle, when he was with Sean Kemp, the Rainmaker, the Rain Man, Gary Payton had – his nickname was the glove.
Yeah.
He had the best defense. He put it on you. Crazy – date back to fucking so what did Payton – he threatened to kill Hill?
Kill everyone.
Just the whole squad.
And he just signed like a mega contract or something. So they were all surprised that he would just like put it out there that he was –
on the court?
Yeah.
He was just threatening
humans. Crazy. He was just threatening to kill just, people.
You know what, man? Yeah. Dude, that was the violence in American culture. We had a movie called – I think it was White Man Can't Jump.
I love that movie.
Yeah, during one of the scenes where the big bully of the court, when Woody and Wesley were hustling people, the big bully was like, you know what? F it. I'm going to go to my car, get my other gun, shoot everybody up. That whole scene.
Now, what was that Latino?
It kind of reminds me.
She's the hottest ever.
Oh, Rosie Perez. Oh. Babe Ruth.
She still looks good.
She's still killing it. She's like 93.
Yeah, good on her.
Yeah, she was commentating on the – she's a big boxing fan. So they had her doing little – the last thing we need are actors and actresses' expertise analyzing on boxing. But I just saw her last weekend.
You can do that. You can put her on mute.
Yeah, Rosie Perez. Hot. Yeah. Oh, you're a Rosie guy.
I'm a big Rosie.
You've already referenced Tristan already earlier, you know, growing up around the Filipinos. Is this something that you'd be interested in interviewing, like, you know, people that you could learn from?
Rosie.
I was trying to. Hell yeah. That's what we're doing, right? We digress. All right.
Guys, thanks for tuning in. Man. Johnny's social media before we leave.
Guys, very simple. Follow me on all socials at Johnny Stofko. Go to that YouTube channel, Johnny Stofko, UTK.
All right. I'm Tristan Cannell, or you can find all our stuff, the Vision Board Podcast, across all the social media channels. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to the show via iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and please leave us a 5-star review.
Guys, we appreciate you.
All right, guys, next week we've got Dana Cavalier coming on. He was in the New York Yankees organizations for 12 years, actually was the head of performance and strength and conditioning in the organization since he was 22 years old.
22, 2009 World Series champ, award winner, Nolan Ryan Award winner, which is the peer award for the best strength and conditioning coach. He was so young, so successful. We're stoked to talk to him.
Absolutely. So check that out. We had a reschedule with Dom. Dom's on Dom
D'Agostino, your boy.
Next week. So, you know, he's a very busy man. So
Joe Rogan, Tim.
Not a lot of people that, you know, get a second chance, but
TVBP.
He gets probably 3 or 4 chances. He's a great guy, and it was just one of those things. He was doing academic stuff.
So. That's it, man. He's totally a researcher. Understand. Researcher.
Yeah.
Studious.
All right, guys. So we'll check you next week.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.